by giving enough other people what they want. However, remember the lesson of the biblical fifth commandment. Trying to give other people what they want only to get what you want does not work very well in the long term. Somehow people sense the ulterior motive. Perhaps it is an air of desperation that you exude. On the face of it, the biblical fifth commandment advises building genuine and sincere relationships with as many people as possible, with no thought of reward. Beneath the surface, it informs you that paradoxically, reward will follow in proportion to the lack of self-interest you projected while forming the relationships in the first place. The success everyone seeks is, in terms of this fifth commandment, only a reward for building those relationships that the author of the Ten Commandments wants his children to form anyway. Consider this true story of success. January 2, 1924, was a bitterly cold day in New York. But Richard Simon had promised to visit his grandmother, who still called him by his Hebrew name, Reuven. During his visit, he discovered that along with her neighbor, his grandmother loved doing crossword puzzles. The two elderly ladies kept one another company during the long winter evenings, working together on the crossword puzzle printed each Sunday in the New York World. The problem was that they usually completed the puzzle by Tuesday. Richard sat thinking for a while. His grandmother's eyes lit up when he asked her whether she would enjoy an entire book of crossword puzzles. "If only such a thing existed," she said. Richard persuaded his friend, a fellow he called Link, to join him in creating and publishing a book of crossword puzzles. The subsequent crossword puzzle book became the foundation of a publishing empire for Richard Simon and his pal Lincoln Schuster, two young Jewish boys from New York. Find opportunities to make many friends. If there is one lesson to be found in Jewish business success, it is this. Find opportunities to become friendly with many people. Jewish communal life undoubtedly offers a head start. Each day commences with a visit to a synagogue for a brief morning service. Traditional Jewish prayer rules call for a minyan, a quorum of 10 men present. Just think about it. 10 men may not sound like much, but the chances are surprisingly high that at least 2 of them share a birthday. You would need 366 men to guarantee that at least 2 share a birthday. So you'd expect the chances of a shared birthday among only 10 men to be pretty low. Instead, a short calculation shows the probability of a shared birthday in a minyan to be as high as 10%. 10 is a good number, not too many to be cumbersome, and not too small to be irrelevant. Sharing a birthday is not the best basis for a relationship. But my point is that among 10 people, many more valuable commonalities will emerge than birthdays, especially if you were to meet those 10 individuals on a basis that was regular enough for friendship to result. If, on a business trip, you had just arrived in a strange city on your very first morning there, you would go to the synagogue and meet at least 9 other men. If each other person there had a circle of, say, 10 other business friends, then you would have suddenly acquired access to 180 potential new friends in a city in which you had just arrived the previous evening. In conversation after services, you would find something in common with at least 1 of the other people there. It might not be a shared birthday, but it would be something more important. Perhaps 2 of you are in similar or complementary businesses, or maybe someone there knows someone whom you'd need to meet. You're probably saying that morning prayer service is not designed for making business contacts. Of course it isn't. But remember that the idea is to make contacts specifically in an environment that does not shriek out your self-interest. This is why regular involvement in a civic service organization, such as Rotary International, does far more for your business than attending a professional breakfast, whose only purpose is to allow attendees to exchange business cards. Rotary allows relationships to develop within an environment of caring for others. Any subsequent business benefit is secondary to those friendships, which is just the way it works best. Those professional breakfasts do not build relationships. They are merely opportunities for self-interested and ambitious people to advertise their business. For the most part, those events tend to attract mostly people who, like Cassius in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, have a lean and hungry look. It becomes apparent almost immediately to those who are enjoying some success, and they stay away from future events in droves. In contrast to those meetings intended only for business professionals to work the room, distributing business cards, Rotary and similar organizations attract all kinds of people, including those who are already very successful. The reason these occasions work so well is simply that most people would rather spend time with professionals gathered for the purpose of helping others, not self-interested people advertising themselves. Prayer services are another perfect place to meet people without the stink of self-interest contaminating the relationship building taking place. That is why attending morning minyan, although certainly not intended directly for this purpose, helps business in the Jewish community. The identical dynamic serves singles seeking a mate. Hanging out at singles events and bars telegraphs a message of pathetic desperation to every other single present. Far better to meet a suitable person at work, a church, on an airplane, or at some social event where the subtle ascent process of relationship building won't be overwhelmed by the smell of the hunt. For the traditional Jewish community, however, morning minyan is just the start. There are services each Sabbath, both on Friday night and on Saturday morning. Very often, the Saturday morning service is highlighted by the celebration of a bar mitzvah, the coming of age of a young man. This attracts still more attendees, both friends and family members, many from out of town. There are many happy events to attend in addition to bar mitzvahs. Jews go out of their way to attend circumcision parties whenever a baby boy is born, and they love to attend weddings. Is it gauche to conduct business while attending the wedding of your second cousin's daughter? Of course it is. During the wedding, you should be focused on nothing but adding to the joy of the celebrants with your presence. However, there is nothing wrong with calling someone with whom you would like to discuss a possible deal, and reminding him that you met him during one of the festive group dances at the wedding the previous weekend. Jews also join with one another for less happy events. They gather for funerals, and they subsequently gather at the home of the bereaved each day for an entire week. These are all activities that cement human relationships in the most profound way. Consider the story of young Aaron Liefer, a Hasidic Jew who lived what most people would consider a fairly isolated life in Brooklyn, New York. As a typical Hasidic teenager, his day started with a before-dawn departure from his home for the synagogue. Early morning prayer services were followed by a day of study in a yeshiva, an academy of Jewish religious study. His day would end at the conclusion of his final lecture at 10 o'clock at night, whereupon he would return home and fall asleep. How did he win Fleet Bank's Youth Entrepreneur Award and also become a millionaire by age 18? Well, he's very comfortable dealing with everyone. It's very unusual, says Steve Kerner, a vice president at Fleet Bank. After his mom bought him a computer, Aaron taught himself basic skills and then began helping others at his school and in his Borough Park neighborhood with their simple computer problems. Finally, his regular clients urged him to accept payment so that they would feel more comfortable calling on him. 2 years later, he had hired 25 of his friends as freelance employees. He had a few hundred clients and $1 million in annual revenue. He now works 14-hour days, 6 days a week, and still studies at the yeshiva for 2 hours each day, and never misses the morning prayer service. What if you're not Jewish? What if you were a woman and unlikely to be included in a traditional Jewish morning service? Well, I wrote this book to be of use to all readers, so fortunately, the principles are readily transferable. I'm explaining the principles behind the many day-to-day practices of Jews over the centuries that have contributed to their excess. Your challenge is to seize these principles, massage them, analyze them, and find your own unique way to apply them to your life. You may not have regular weekday services to attend, but you could always join a synagogue or church or a sports or civic group in order to become friendly with more people. There are many other ways to seek new friends. It is true that women are excluded from the business opportunities that surface during informal time at men-only venues. However, there are other venues that are women-only, such as many sports clubs and gyms, at which women will have excellent opportunities to form friendships. I think that, in general, women tend to be better than men at bonding with one another. Whatever your situation, I absolutely guarantee you that opportunities to meet others do exist in your life. You may never have contemplated them, but if you brainstorm, you will find them. Forge friendships by creating ongoing obligations. Having located the many opportunities that exist in your life to extend your network of connectedness, how does one best establish contact? The clue is found within the Hebrew word for friend, chaver. The etymological root of that word is chav, which means indebtedness or obligation. The idea is that friendship is forged and maintained by the dynamic creating and discharging of obligation on a continuous basis. Just do something for someone, and you are on the road to a relationship. This is one reason that on a dinner date, any man seeking a relationship will be eager to pay for the meal. Everyone is familiar with the important little rituals of friendship. I invite you to dinner, after which you write me a thank you note. You give me a birthday gift, and I send over a bottle of your favorite wine. I help your daughter find a job, and you get me rare tickets for a popular ball game. While one party to the relationship creates an obligation by presenting a gift, the other reveals a vulnerability by accepting the gift and expressing gratitude. The Hebrew word for thank you, hodeh, is the same as the Hebrew word for admission or confession. Expressing gratitude is equivalent to confessing subservience. By accepting your gift gratefully, I am telling you that when you bestowed that gift on me, you supplied something missing in me. By my acceptance of your gift and by my gratitude, I am confessing that I needed you. If at any time I need you, that makes me the subservient one at that moment. At another time, I may be the one creating the obligation by doing something for you, while you become vulnerable when you accept my offering. This ongoing dynamic forms and sustains relationships in the same way that two cities can be linked by cars hurtling to and fro along the connecting road, and by electronic messages that fly back and forth along the telephone wires that run alongside the road. Now, some people may say, "Well, that is all very materialistic. My friendships are far too real and personal to require gifts and thank you notes. My friend knows that I care for him, and we don't need those little scraps of tangible evidence." This is a lot like the person who thinks he has discovered that one doesn't really need to water flowers. In fact, he thinks, one can even detach them from their plants and carry them indoors to brighten up a room. A little while later, when the flower has faded and died, the foolish horticulturalist realizes that the water and the nurturing plant did serve a purpose after all. They provided sustenance and durability. Without them, the flower eventually died. Similarly, friends who abandon these rituals that constantly form and discharge mutual obligation soon discover friendship fading. Constantly creating and discharging obligations nurtures and sustains a friendship. There are two ways to create the obligation-vulnerability dynamic that forms friendships between two people. There are unilateral actions that either one can initiate and perform, such as one bestowing a gift on the other. Then there are also other activities that the two of them can share, such as experiencing a sunrise together. In this case, the gift of the sunrise, if you will, is coming from outside the pair, while they both experience a vulnerability to the moment. Though both of these two types of activity work well in building and nourishing friendship, the second is more perilous. There are experiences that two can share that do very little for a relationship. Suppose two people spend an evening in the same room watching television. We know that the time spent in this fashion does nothing for their relationship, because they could just as well have been two travelers watching CNN News on the monitor in an airport waiting area. It is unlikely for them to establish any connection between them. Any woman inveigled into watching a football game on television with her boyfriend knows how little good the afternoon spent in this fashion did for their feelings for one another. Taking a hike together, one teaching the other a new skill, or one giving a gift to the other, are all examples of activities that do enhance a relationship. The key to knowing whether an activity or an experience will enhance a relationship is to measure how active or passive the roles of the people involved are. Are they subjects or objects in the sentence describing the activity? If both are utterly passive, the actual time spent in the activity has accomplished very little, although subsequently discussing the activity is an active process that does benefit a relationship. For instance, time spent in a movie theater does little for the relationship of the two people watching Hollywood's latest spectacle. However, eating dinner together after the show and discussing the movie does a great deal for their relationship. Use these principles in establishing relationships. Remember, though, you are not trying to expand your business Rolodex. You are trying to warm your life with new relationships. This one single point is both the hardest to absorb into your being and at the same time the most valuable clue to relationship building. You are trying to build relationships with other human beings, not seeking new people to use. Succeeding in genuine relationship building will eventually increase your income. Just as important, it will immediately start improving your entire life. Murder and the City. How only crowds of people can create wealth. Jewish tradition has always encouraged its followers to view cities as places that offer them the most opportunities to do the most good for the most people. That is just another way of saying that cities offer the most opportunities for creating wealth. Far from merely a gruesome story of sibling rivalry, the biblical account of Cain murdering Abel serves as a practical lesson in understanding cities. This story turns out to contain the seeds of history's first city. First, we must find out the interpretation that Jewish tradition places on Cain's crime. What could have motivated him to wipe out about a quarter of the world's population? The clue is in a name, his own name. Jewish tradition considers all names to be meaningful. Each biblical name is linked to its readily identifiable root word. For instance, Adam means earth, signifying that is where he came from. And Eve means life, as she is to be the mother of all life. Cain means acquisition, in order to signify that his entire essence is acquisitiveness. Apparently, acquiring wealth was the most important thing in the world to Cain. Aha! Here is a convincing motive for murder. This answer provides a depressing but ultimately accurate view of human nature. The result of Adam and Eve having been banished from the Garden of Eden is that death exists in the world. Obviously, that would leave Cain and his brother Abel as the eventual inheritors of their parents' legacy, the entire world. Jewish oral tradition focuses on an ambiguous sentence that appears at this point of the biblical narrative. And Cain spoke to Abel his brother, and this was while they were in the field. And Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. The glaring questions are, what did Cain say to his brother in the field? And how did Abel's response precipitate history's first homicide? Recorded tradition fills in the gap, stating that Cain, realizing that acquiring the entire world was twice as good as owning only half the world, indicated his intent as older brother to seize everything. Abel rejected this idea, leading Cain to achieve his ends by killing his brother. This is followed by the well-known question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" spoken by Cain in response to the Lord charging Cain with murder. Now here is where the lesson the Jews draw from this account becomes interesting. For Gilbert and Sullivan's famous opera, The Mikado, Sir William Gilbert wrote that a more humane Mikado never did in Japan exist. For him it was axiomatic that a great and just king would punish according to the crime. Gilbert had his humane Mikado sing, "My object all sublime I shall achieve in time, to let the punishment fit the crime, the punishment fit the crime. And make each prisoner pent, unwillingly represent, a source of innocent merriment, of innocent merriment." To Jews it is axiomatic that when God punishes people, the punishment always fits the crime with divine precision. In the case of Cain's act of murder, then, what is the divine response? Will Cain be sentenced to death? No. Instead, he is punished this way. When you work the ground, it will no longer continue to yield its strength to you. A vagrant and a wanderer is what you will now become. What? From now on, Cain can plow and plant, but he'll never harvest? How does this punishment fit the crime of murder? There is cosmic justice at work here. To the Jew, there have always been only two ways to grow wealthy from land. Cain's mistaken presumption was that the road to wealth lay in reducing the number of his competitors. God's message to humanity through Cain is that, one, you can plant wheat, or two, you can build shopping centers. In other words, agriculture or development are the choices. However, the latter is only an option if there are many people around. Without a population, the only thing it makes sense to do with your land is plant food. God seems to be saying to Cain, "You wanted the wealth that would have come from owning the entire world, right? Well, you've got yourself all the world now. Let's see what the limitless agricultural land will do for you once I command it not to yield to your farming." As if that is not enough, God continues with more punishment. Again, one expects to hear God sentence Cain to some sort of punishment that is an appropriate quid pro quo for murder. Instead, Cain is told that having wanted the entire world, he now is condemned to wander the vast lands he has inherited, never tarrying in one place long enough to make friends, let alone create relationships. Cain will never be in any one place long enough to build a building, let alone lots of buildings. And he'll never be in one place long enough to find tenants for his buildings, even if he could build them. God now awaits Cain's response. Will he or won't he finally understand that wealth comes from interacting and cooperating with many other people, not killing them? Does the text poured over by generations of devoted Jews reveal an answer? Cain appeals the severity of the sentence and wins some kind of reprieve that allows him to settle in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now Cain commences the process of atonement, which is trying to make up for his hideous crime. The very next thing that the Bible reveals is that Cain conceives a child with his wife. This action of bringing a new life into the world is precisely the opposite of his earlier mistake of taking a life out of the world. Jews have understood that Cain is now committed to rebuilding the population from the fact that the Bible does not even mention his wife's name, or even the information that he had married. When most people marry, they do so with a deep commitment to the person they are marrying. A progeny is not the only motivation. That is why the news of weddings is usually broadcast before the good news of births. In this case, however, Cain is primarily interested in rebuilding the world's population. This is viewed as a good sign, because it signifies that he understands the true nature of his earlier mistake. Here comes the climax of the entire story. Cain's wife bore him a son called Enoch, and immediately Cain began building his legacy to his son. He built a city. Cain truly has learned the source of wealth. So profound was Cain's education that the name he gave his new son celebrated his education. The name Enoch in Hebrew means just that, education. Cain even bestowed the same uplifting name on his new city called Enoch, education. From this biblical chapter describing Cain's eventual education, Jewish children have grasped the essential message. Wealth is created in a populated city far more easily than in all the vast countryside with its silent loneliness. Do you want wealth? Cain seems to be asking. If so, locate yourself in the heart of large populations of people who share your values. Then begin making connections. Improving connections enhances wealth creation. It is no accident that the graph depicting wealth creation in the United States has always spiked upward in concert with the adoption of technological developments that have aided humans in relating with one another. The invention and rapid adoption of the telegraph did for the Victorian era what the Internet has done for the present day. The telegraph ended what I call the Paul Revere era of communication. Up until the telegraph's arrival, the fastest way to convey information was by sending a man on a horse. By the time that folks in Baltimore could find out about low prices caused by a wheat surplus in Chicago, the information was no longer useful. The telegraph and the spread of railroads across the United States changed all that and helped in the creation of vast wealth. The 20th century was surely shaped by development in communication. It also became the greatest wealth-producing period in our history. As late as 1920, only 35% of U.S. households had a telephone. By the end of the century, penetration was complete, with many homes possessing more than one line. By 1930, Only 39% of homes had a radio. By the end of the century, virtually every home had several radios and a color television, including those homes that the U.S. Census Bureau considers to be below the poverty line. That communication accompanies wealth creation is not surprising. This is precisely the message the Jews extract from the Cain story. The contemporary significance of this message is best revealed by analyzing what economic life might look like for the last person on earth. Imagine some catastrophe that wipes out all human beings but one. Surely the survivor is the wealthiest human ever to inhabit the planet. The survivor owns not only Fort Knox, but also all the gold beneath the offices of the Federal Reserve in New York City. He has access to every safe deposit box and owns every office building in the heart of every city. He owns more airplanes and yachts than have ever been owned by anyone in all of human history. You might peer into the daily life of this unprecedented tycoon. What does he do once the sun goes down on his first day as ruler of the world? Why, read by candlelight, of course, because lights no longer go on at the touch of a switch. Nobody is left to operate the electricity utility. At first he will eat fairly well, at least until the grocery stores, all of which now belong to him, run out of produce. Sooner or later, even the canned foods will spoil. At that point he had better hope that his first harvest ripens successfully before he starves to death. He may desire to travel. At first, he is free to choose any car on the road because they all belong to him. However, sooner or later, they will all have empty gas tanks and will become quite useless to him. If he can catch a horse, he might be able to travel at a rate faster than he could walk, but that is his best hope. On his own, he could not operate a refinery to produce the petroleum that would so ease his life. It quickly becomes apparent that the richest man in history is enjoying a living standard slightly below that of a third-world subsistence farmer. In contrast, the more opportunities people have to interact and to convey information to one another, the more wealth is created for every participant. Now you know why so many people play golf. It is not just because of the endless fascination and deep intrigue that accompanies chasing a ball around a big field, only to whack it again once you have located it. You may have picked up the subtle clues that I'm not a golfer, but at least I know I should be. You know why? Because golf allows people to experience long and intimate conversation with others, while self-interest is camouflaged by the game. Ask people why they play golf with business associates, and the answer is always the same. It's a great way to build relationships. How does this knowledge help you? For a start, it suggests that you need to maximize your interaction with other people. Although it is certainly true that modern advances in telecommunications allows you to be in business despite geographic isolation, moving to a small and remote community might not be the best way to prepare for your new life of economic success. In addition, if you happen to prefer spending your leisure time isolated with a good book or glued to a television set, now might be a good time to start using most of your available time for building new relationships. Is doing so going to be comfortable for you? Initially, probably not, particularly if you are the introverted sort. However, you are going to have to change if you're serious about money. You must enlarge your Rolodex, and you must intensify the relationships with the people you represented by those Rolodex cards. Never miss or ignore an opportunity to make new friends and to nurture existing ones. You can always make a point of accepting invitations to others' happy events. And yes, you can always make a point of attending others' sad events, too. In other words, engage in ongoing community-building activities. These days, everyone is busy, It is all too easy to casually dismiss invitations and other opportunities to spend time with others. This is a mistake. How about if you have already been declining invitations for so long that you now hardly receive any? Or what if you are relatively new in town? Two of the ways in which channels of communication are built are receiving invitations and dispatching them. A Jewish tradition links three seemingly separate pieces of information. It is said, one, that Abraham built a close circle of friends numbering at least 20,000 souls. Two, that Abraham constantly invited guests into his home. And three, that his large tent had doorways facing each of the four approaching roads. The historical aspects are irrelevant for our purposes, but the business lesson is powerful. Even today's large department stores have absorbed the third of Abraham's lessons, making it easy for guests to enter the premises. They all possess multiple entrances facing different directions and opening onto different streets. You, too, can make your home inviting to guests, and you can similarly increase your circle of friends by inviting guests to enjoy your hospitality. Bestowing your hospitality on someone is the very best way of establishing a bond. Grabbing the bill at a restaurant is one way of doing this. Another is inviting your new friend to join you for dinner at home. Not only is it considerably less expensive to entertain at home than at a restaurant, but it is also far more effective at creating bonds. For this reason, in long ago days, when companies were contemplating hiring a particular executive, in addition to extensively interviewing the candidate, they would also interview his wife. Their concern was whether she would be an adequate hostess for those all-important home dinner parties. Today, life is considerably less simple, but the principles need to be recognized and applied to whatever realities surround your own life. Helping others improve their lives helps you improve your own life. Finding genuine joy in friendship with others and cultivating many such friendships is essential. This alone, however, is not sufficient. One must be master of some way to help others live their lives. For example, suppose I have 90 minutes available this afternoon. Because time is the scarcest commodity, I want to decide very carefully how to invest that time. I could watch a game on television, but that would not be an investment of my time. Instead, it would be a dissipation of my valuable hour and a half. I could mow my lawn with my hand-pushed lawnmower, which would at least have a health benefit for me. Or I could finish writing a manual for a car dealership owned by a friend of mine. The car dealership had provided me with details of its operation and desperately needed a flowchart-based operation manual. Writing the car manual for my friend is the best use of my time. Here's why. Once I have completed writing the manual after about 90 minutes, I can drive over to the dealership, give my handiwork to the owner, and pick up a check for $350, the agreed-on price for the work. When I get home again, I find that the person I hired to mow the lawn has just about finished the job. I happily pay her the $60 we had negotiated and retire to my armchair to think about life. During the passage of the past 2 hours or so, instead of mowing the lawn, I had made two people happy. Three, if you count my wife who wanted the lawn mowed. On top of that, I still made myself a profit of $290. I could have mowed the lawn myself, but it would not have looked as good as it looked after being manicured by someone who really knew her job. Life is a miracle, provided you have many friends, and provided everyone knows what everyone else does best. That, of course, is the value of advertising. Don't be a wage slave. Be in business for yourself. One of the first questions that new acquaintances ask one another is, "What do you do?" or "What field are you in?" You need to be able to answer that question with no more than about 20 seconds of description. What is more, you need to answer that question in a way that sounds absolutely fascinating and that almost compels your interlocutor to ask further questions. Now, if your answer is nothing more than, "Oh, I work for the Acme Ball Bearing Company," you have squandered a potential wealth-producing opportunity. You have told me nothing really interesting about yourself. What do you do for Acme? Are you the chairman? Are you in sales, production, or accounting? Now, had you smiled broadly and said, "Oh, I show manufacturers, chiefly the Acme Company, how to produce the smoothest, shiniest, hardest little spheres in the whole universe," you might well have fascinated me. Apart from anything else, people with expressive faces who are really passionate about something are just more fun to interact with. If all you can tell me is that you work for someone else and are at his beck and call, frankly, I'd rather speak with him. He sounds more interesting than you. So, no matter how you serve your fellow humans, think of yourself as doing something fascinating. See yourself in business rather than merely being something. What if you have no passion for your work? Trying to earn money doing something you dislike is equivalent to boxing with one hand tied behind your back. You need to do everything in your power to cultivate an interest in what you do. If that is impossible, I would suggest finding a position you can be passionate about. Obviously, every job has its less stimulating moments, but you should feel an enthusiasm for what you do, be it flipping burgers or running a multi-million-dollar company. Some people follow this logic to a false conclusion. They assume that the pay is irrelevant so long as they are doing what they enjoy. I met quite a few destitutes on the Venice, California beachfront where the synagogue I served was situated. They all assured me that they were writing the great American screenplay. Being a great writer was their dream, but they scoffed at the idea that because their work enjoyed no commercial success, they should consider alternative employment opportunities. What should you do if the work you do and love is not remunerative? Unless you are one of the lucky few for whom money is not a concern, you might do one of two things. Perhaps your passion needs to be fulfilled in your leisure time as a hobby or through a volunteer situation. Meanwhile, grow an enthusiasm for a field you may never have earlier considered. Too many people fixate on a very small number of careers and remain unaware of the myriad of amazing opportunities the working world offers. Sometimes you can think in an unconventional way and channel your preferences into a more lucrative field. One of my daughters has loved teaching since she was 5 years old. While other girls set their dolls up at little tea parties, my daughter's dolls were lined up in a little classroom on her bed. She would spend hours instructing them while writing on her blackboard, which had been her favorite birthday present. She eventually grew up, left home, and became a teacher. The stark reality she encountered was that although she found her work immensely fulfilling, her paycheck did not reflect the many hours she invested in preparation, grading, and teaching. Thinking creatively, she quit her position and pursued the less time-consuming but far more lucrative field of tutoring students for their forthcoming Scholastic Aptitude Tests, SATs. And also creating for schools curricula that utilized many of the innovative techniques she had used in her classroom. Traditional Jews understand the difference between being a wage slave and being in business. And so should you. You can be an employee without being a wage slave. There is the old tale of two friends who met up again 20 years after they both first began working for the railroad. The fellow wielding a pick while working on the roadbed was astounded to see his old friend looking prosperous as he stepped from his private rail car. In response, the second guy, now head of the railroad, explained, 20 years ago, you went to work for $3.75 an hour, whereas I went to work for the railroad. His point was that his unsuccessful friend always saw himself as a wage slave and focused on his meager salary. He, on the other hand, saw himself as being in business for himself, which allowed him to focus on his customer, in this case, his employer. Just watch the owner of that shoe store eagerly greet every customer walking through the door. Does she feel surly and resentful toward them in the way that so many employees feel toward their bosses? No, she does not. That is because she thinks of herself as being in business, and these customers are not her employers, but her customers. Even an employee can do exactly the same thing. He can and must consider himself to be in business. All he must do is view his employer as one of his customers. Consider the difference in success and happiness of two of my friends, Henry and Harvey. Henry is a dentist working for a large dental health group in town and doing very well indeed. Harvey does something or other in the passenger cabin division of a large aircraft manufacturer. I think he is an engineer of sorts. Harvey is also a wage slave. Is there something about being an engineer that is inherently different from being a dentist? Not really. But the reason Harvey is a wage slave is also why I don't know exactly what Harvey does. Harvey never talks about his work, whereas Henry never misses an opportunity to talk about his work and always exploits the slightest opportunity to tell folks about the latest advances in dentistry that he is mastering. Admittedly, in the ordinary course of life, Henry will run into more people who need fillings than Harvey will run into, who need large jet aircraft. However, Henry sees everyone he meets as someone he could potentially assist with a tooth problem. Harvey misses countless opportunities, not to sell aircraft, but to sell himself. In the company of Harvey, I found myself at a social event one evening and met two people who could have done business with Harvey if they had only known what business he was in. I thought Harvey worked as an engineer for Boeing, because that's how he had introduced himself to these two people. Wrong. Harvey was really in the business of converting blueprints into finished products. But he didn't know it. His biggest current client, and admittedly at present his only client, was Boeing. He mistakenly saw Boeing as his employer rather than as his client. Who cares? I care about what you do for Boeing and what you might be able to do for others, like those two people. Both people mentioned to me that they were each desperately in need of more production engineers for their factories. One was a national luggage manufacturer, and the other manufactured plastic vacuum molding machinery. Either of them would have offered Harvey a compensation package worth effectively double what he was earning at Boeing. Either would also have offered him considerably more security than Boeing, which is constantly laying off workers, only to attempt rehiring them about 4 years later. Too bad Harvey was only an employee. Too bad Harvey was not on the lookout for new clients for Harvey, Inc. Be proud of and let people know what you do. This book's second commandment could be summarized thus. Make lots of new friends. Try to help them, and make sure that they all know how you could help them, and that you are eager to do so. Many people like Harvey hide their occupations. I think this sometimes is a lingering sense of British snobbery. In England, it used to be lower class to earn your money. Far better, they felt, to inherit and then dissipate it. One of the most snide pre-World War II British insults used to be, "Oh, he's just a merchant." Far wiser instead to be proud of how you earn your living, what you do, what you can do, and your eagerness to do it. That is what opens up doors. Against all odds, and in the face of cultural and regulatory difficulties, many Jews in Europe did very well financially. One way they got around some of the difficulties they faced was by announcing with their choices of names exactly how they could be helpful to other people. Jacob the Glazer was the village glassman. Isaac the Drucker was the printer. And Joseph Diamond was the jeweler. Weinberg produced and sold wine, while Feller owned the tannery. Schneider was the tailor. Cooper made barrels, and Wasserman brought the water. People weren't embarrassed to have their identity linked to a job or a way of earning a living. The Talmud records the names of many great scholars and eminent sages who were known by their occupations, such as Rabbi Yochanan, the shoemaker. Jews were encouraged by these Talmudic heroes with their distinctive names to proudly declare their occupations, too. Jews also take the lesson to heart from Jonah, prophet of God, who was woken by the sailors terrified of the storm that threatened their ship. In an effort to identify the menace, the frightened men inquired of Jonah, "Tell us who caused this storm. Was it you? What is your occupation? Where are you from?" To this day, one of the first questions people tend to ask a new acquaintance is, "What do you do for a living?" It is a legitimate question because the inquirer really wants to know what the person does for other people. He or she is wondering how others find you useful. How you help your fellow human beings is a proud part of your identity. The only person to be embarrassed by the question is one who has no answer. Traditionally, Jews have been quick to identify their occupations. This obviously makes it much simpler for others to make contact for business purposes, and it may be partially responsible for Jews acquiring the reputation of being forward and aggressive in business. Letting folks know your occupation benefits everyone, and need not be obtrusive or obnoxious. Choose your friends and customers carefully. Anytime someone is about to tell you the secret of life, you should interrupt and ask how long it will take to tell you this secret of life. If he or she answers anything under 3 years, don't waste your time. There is no way to communicate the secret of life in 30 seconds because there probably is not only one secret to life. One can easily fall into the trap of suggesting simple aphorisms to solve all of life's complex problems. One obvious flaw in simple sayings is that many of them are countered by equally pithy sayings urging precisely the opposite course of action. "Absence makes the heart grow fonder" is unlikely to comfort the distant lover when he recalls the opposite, "out of sight, out of mind." The timid soul happily hears, "Look before you leap," but his equanimity is shattered when someone reminds him he who hesitates is lost. People often procrastinate and reassure themselves with, "Don't cross that bridge till you come to it." But they must also remember, a stitch in time saves nine. Life is far too complex for these one-liners to serve as fail-safe guides, and your business career should be too inextricably woven into the fabric of your life to allow it to be governed by just one proverb. You have often heard the expression, "The customer is always right." Well, like all the other examples I just cited, this one is also unreliable. Have you never encountered a truly obnoxious customer who is clearly not in the right? Here's a painful thought. Have you ever been the sort of customer who was certainly not right? For example, Nordstrom is just one of several stores that discovered that not all customers are right. These stores find that their generous return policies are occasionally exploited by certain customers who take home dresses with the intention of wearing them for a special occasion and then returning them. Those customers are not always right, and up-to-date techniques are being used to screen for these customers and to try to encourage them to do their shopping elsewhere. Another example is Paging Network, Inc., a paging services provider that for several years essentially gave away its pagers in a race to build market share. In 1998, the company began to chase away heavy users who receive a flurry of messages but often pay only a rock-bottom monthly fee. By the end of 1998, Paging Network, Inc. had cut loose nearly 500,000 unprofitable former customers. Here's a third example. During 1997, FedEx began analyzing the returns on its business for about 30 large customers that generate about 10% of its total volume. It found that certain customers, including some requiring lots of residential deliveries, weren't bringing in as much revenue as they had promised when they first negotiated discounted rates. So FedEx went on the offensive, demanding that some customers pay higher rates and imposing double-digit increases in a handful of instances. A couple of big customers who refused to budge were told they could take their shipping business elsewhere. Finally, consider how several credit card companies have decided on the profile of the ideal customer with whom they wish to deal. If you fall into that category, when you phone them, you will reach a real live operator who will quickly and efficiently tend to your request. Perhaps you are the sort of customer who always pays your credit card balances in full and always on time, never incurring any finance charge or late fees. Or you may be the sort of customer who misses even the minimum monthly payment. In both these cases, when you call the credit card company's customer service line, Caller ID software identifies you as, shall we say, a less desirable customer, the kind of customer who is not always right from their point of view. In this case, you will never reach a live operator. Instead, you will be programmed to pick from an endless succession of choices and finally left to meander through the futile footpaths of voicemail until you finally surrender with a sigh and hang up. Clearly, running the complexity of your business by the simplistic credo that the customer is always right is a recipe for failure. Instead, accustom yourself to first examine the transaction and the people involved. That way, you can do what department stores and credit card companies do. Determine whether the other party is indeed a customer. If this person is someone with whom you would like to conduct a transaction, then he or she is a customer. Suppose you are in the plumbing business, and your business plan calls for you to develop relationships with owners of large apartment buildings. Your work is competent and quick. All you care about is stopping the leak and getting on to the next call. One day you receive a call from the mansion of a temperamental dowager who expects a plumber to show up on her doorstep in gleaming white coveralls and color-coordinated operating room booties. You would be wise to decline the call. She is not your customer. Accepting her as a customer and following the rule that the customer is always right will ruin your day, if not your week. Having determined that someone is indeed a customer with whom you would want to conduct business, how do you relate to that customer? Suppose that customer is being a bit difficult, as customers often are. One danger with saying that the customer is always right is that it generates feelings of resentment in you when the customer is clearly not right. Instead of trying to inculcate within yourself and your employees the ethos that the customer is always right, try inculcating the idea of the principle of service. The customer may be wrong, obnoxious, and ugly, but you have determined that this is a customer you want to win, please, and retain. That means that whether the customer is right or wrong is immaterial. What is very material, however, is your attitude.